from PRI, Public Radio International.
He alone knew something was seriously wrong. When would his daughter realize, he wondered. What, he wondered, was happening. There were days. They kept coming and going. He opened his mouth and he closed his mouth. Mostly what he heard form on his tongue made sense, but sometimes not. When not, he entered into an elaborate and oblique process of trying to convey what he had, in fact, intended. In the best of circumstances, the persons or person came up with the words themselves and offered them to him. Nodding, not speaking, he accepted them, hoping that when he next opened his mouth, his brain and tongue would have realigned.
That was David Strathern reading a brief excerpt from Brian Evanson's story, Mutter Tongue. And this is Selected Shorts, a celebration of the short story. I'm Isaiah Sheffer, Artistic Director of Symphony Space on Broadway and 95th Street on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, where Selected Shorts originates. We begin this program with a story from an evening we called An Evening with McSweeney's, for which we invited the editors of that remarkable and innovative magazine that specializes in new young authors to choose and show us some of their wares. Here is the managing editor of McSweeney's, Eli Horowitz, speaking from the stage of Symphony Space.
Hi, I'm Eli Horowitz, manager of McSweeney's. If I look too young to be hosting an event that's of this classy sort, it's because I am too young. But I'm really grateful to Symphony Space and Isaiah for having us here. And I tried to be a little classy. I'm wearing this outfit. I tucked in my shirt and everything, and I wore these shoes, which I'm not used to. But for you, I'm really pulling out all the stops. So I'm going to give a very brief introduction to McSweeney's, and then we'll get on to the readings of the story. This is just, some of you all know this, some of you who are in the McSweeney's crowd may already know this. If you're wondering whether or not you're in the McSweeney's crowd, you can think about various factors. If you've showered recently, whether $20 seemed like a lot of money tonight, things like that. I am in the McSweeney's crowd, but I have showered recently because there's a shower backstage. But $20 does seem like a lot. But it's a good deal. You're having a good show tonight. It'll be worth at least $25 or $26. McSweeney's. McSweeney's is a small publishing company based in San Francisco. It was founded in 1998 by Dave Eggers. At the time, it was just it was this kind of strange hodgepodge of lonely stories and essays that couldn't find a home anywhere else. And so we gave them a home, just slapped them between some covers, sent it out to people. Started very small, just 1,000 copies, I think. Since then, it's become stranger and stranger. It's attracted writers like Michael Chabon, Nick Hornby, A.M. Holmes, Zadie Smith, Joyce Carol Oates, all sorts of people. And we've tried to play with the form a little bit also. And so the next story is Mutter Tongue by Brian Evanson. And Brian Evanson is a pretty remarkable writer, and I think this is a pretty remarkable story. I think what he does especially well here is he's doing a lot of things at the same time, things that seemed like they wouldn't mesh. And so on one hand, it's got a lot of love of language and sort of a pleasure in the wordplay. And also, it's very much a fable and has that structure, that sort of start, middle, and ending, and a neatness to it, and almost a surreality. But then it's also a really human and wrenching story. And I don't know how I managed to do them all at once, but I think he does them well. And here's David Strathern to read it.
There came a certain point in his speech, in his confrontation with others, in his smattering with the world, that Hecker realized something was wrong. Language was starting to slip in his mouth, words substituting themselves for one another. And while his own thoughts remained lucid as ever, sometimes they could only be made manifest on his tongue if they were wrung out or twisted or set with false eyes. False eyes? Something like that. His sense of language had always been slightly fluid. It had always been easy for him, when distracted, to substitute one word for another based on sound or rhythm or association or analogy, which was why people thought him absent-minded. But this was different. Then, when distracted, he hadn't known when he misspoke, had only been cued by the expression on the faces of those around him to backtrack and correct. Now, he heard himself say the wrong word, knew it to be wrong even while he was saying it, but was powerless to correct it. There was something seriously wrong with him, something broken. He could grasp that, but could not understand where it was taking him. The first time it happened, the look on his face had been one of appalled wonder, or so he guessed from the look of glee his daughter offered in return. "Oh, Daddy," she said, for even though she was mostly grown, she still called him Daddy for reasons he neither understood nor encouraged. "It's not gravy, you mean, but fishing." "Gravy?" he thought. "Fishing?" There was too far a gap between the two terms to leap from one to the other by any logic available to him. He had heard his voice say gravy while his mind was busy transmitting fishing to his tongue. He was amazed by what he heard coming out of his mouth, didn't understand why it didn't have some relation to his thoughts. But to his daughter, he was merely the same old father, absent-minded, distracted. "Oh," he said, "of course, termite," and was amazed again. But to his daughter, he was only playing a game, taunting her. And then, a moment later, he was fine. He could say fishing again when he meant fishing. He alone knew something was seriously wrong. When would his daughter realize, he wondered. What, he wondered, was happening. There were days. They kept coming and going. He opened his mouth and he closed his mouth. Mostly what he heard form on his tongue made sense, but sometimes not. When not, he entered into an elaborate and oblique process of trying to convey what he had, in fact, intended. In the best of circumstances, the persons or person came up with the words themselves and offered them to him. Nodding, not speaking, he accepted them, hoping that when he next opened his mouth, his brain and tongue would have realigned. He quickly acquired a dread of meetings, of speaking in front of his colleagues. Once, his language collapsed in the middle of articulating a complaint against his chair, colleagues touching their glasses or faces and staring at him and waiting for him to go on. Fear-stricken enough to improvise, he stood, speechless and shaking his head, and walked out. Some of them later congratulated him on his courageous gesture, but others shied away. His daughter began to notice a tentativeness to him, though that was not how she would have phrased it. But he could see her watching him, slightly puzzled. His past personal behavior had been eccentric enough, he discovered, that she was willing to give him an alibi for almost anything, and yet she still sensed something was wrong. At night, after she claimed to have gone to bed, he would sometimes hear her sliding through the halls. He would shift in his cushion on the sofa to find her behind in the doorway, staring at the back of his head. "Why do you Melba?" he said to her. "Pronto." She looked at him seriously, as if she understood, and then, nodding, returned to bed. The dog began acting strangely, panting heavily around him, keeping a distance when he tried to approach, creeping slowly off with its tail flattened out. "Am I the same person?" he wondered. Perhaps that was it, he thought. Perhaps he was not. Or perhaps he was only part of himself, and whoever else he also was had never learned to speak properly. He tried to make friends with the dog again, offering it treats, which sometimes it took gingerly with its teeth, careful not to touch his hand. In the classroom, where before he had been sure of himself, aggressive even, he became jittery, always waiting for the moment when the smooth surface of his language would be perforated. He He took to dividing his students into small groups, speaking to them as little as possible. He tried, mornings before a class, to practice what he was going to say to propel them into their groups as quickly as possible, how to deflect or quickly answer any potential questions. But however many times he uttered his spiel perfectly beforehand, the actual moment of recitation was always up for grabs. He instead began practicing alternatives for each sentence. On the first moment of collapse, he would switch, attempting to get the same thing across with a different sentence pattern, entirely different words. But if a sentence crumbled, which it did once or twice per class, often enough in any case that the students, like his dog, like his daughter, like his colleagues, seemed now always to be looking at him oddly, the alternative usually crumbled away as well. But if a third variant did not hold, the fourth usually did, if there had to be a fourth, for by that time his mind had cycled around to a track that allowed it direct contact with his tongue again. And thus it took a number of weeks before he found himself standing at the front of the class with all his options exhausted in the gravest misspeakings, each more outrageous than the last, so much so that he was afraid to say another word. The class, a carefully wrapped part of him noted, was more uniformly attentive than they had been at any other time in the semester, peculiarly primed to receive knowledge. But he had nothing to offer them. So instead he turned, wrote something banal on the board, "Nature of evil, consider and discuss." And then suddenly he could speak again. For a time, it seemed that writing would be his salvation. In the classroom, whenever his words started to come out maddened or stippled or gargled, he would turn to the board and write what he had actually meant. This worked fine up to a point, though he had to admit it sometimes looked odd when he suddenly stopped speaking and began to write. But still, it could be dismissed by students as mere eccentricity or as an attempt to avoid having to repeat something twice. At home, such a strategy was more fraughter. Any time he tried it with his daughter, he found her turning away before he could find a pen, she perhaps believing that he had decided to ignore her. Elsewhere, too, it didn't seem to work. At a restaurant, one could point at an item on the menu, but this wasn't well received, and the one time he tried this in a social situation, it was thought he was making fun of the deaf. But there were other places it did work. He could talk to his colleagues by note or email as long as he wasn't physically present. He also tried leaving his daughter scrawled messages, but she chose to ignore them or pretended she hadn't seen them. Once, when he asked her about one, whether she had seen it, she looked at him fixedly for some time before finally rolling her eyes and saying, "Yes, Daddy." "Well," he said. "Well, what? What's your answer?" She shook her head. "No answer." "But," he said, "Corfu." "Corfu," she said. "In Greece, what are you talking about? Don't play games with me, Daddy." "Sandwich," he said and covered his mouth. "Here I am, Daddy," she said, angry. "Right here. I'm usually right here. I am not going to let you mess with me. If you want to ask me something, you can just open your mouth and ask me." But he couldn't just open his mouth, he realized. He didn't dare. "Sandwich," he thought. He sat staring at her, hand over mouth, trying to gather the courage to speak, to misspeak, until, fuming, she gave a little cry and marched out of the room. As his condition worsened, he stayed silent for hours. His daughter rallied, sometimes referring to him railingly as the recluse, as in, "How's the old recluse this morning?" At other times, merely accusing him of becoming pensive in his dotage. Where, he wondered, had she picked up the word dotage? The frequency of his misgivings, his misspeakings, grew, until finally he felt he could no longer meet his class. The last few weeks of the term, he phoned in sick nearly every day, or rather had his daughter phone in for him. He sent his lesson plans in by email, got a colleague to fill in for him, finally wrote a letter to the department chair requesting early retirement. You're lonely, his daughter said to him one evening. You need to get out more. He shook his head, no. You need to date, she said. Do you want me to set you up with someone? He shook his head emphatically, no. All right, she said, a date it is. I'll see what I can do. She began to bring home brochures from dating services and left the Women Seeking Men page of the city's weekly out with a few choice ads circled. Was he adventuresome? No, he thought, reading the ads, he was not. Did he like long walks and a romantic dinner for two on the beach? No, he did not care for sand in his food. Bookish? Well, yes, but this woman's idea of high lit, as it turned out later in the ad, was John Irving. Unless the Irving referred to was Washington Irving of Sleepy Hollow fame. Was that any better? And what would he put in his own ad? SWM, well past prime, losing ability to speak, looks for special companionship that goes beyond words. He groaned and arranged everything in a neat little stack at the back of his desk. A few days later, email messages began showing up addressed to Silver Fox, or The Silver Fox, or in one case, Mr. F. Silver. They were all women who claimed to have seen his posting and who were interested. They wanted, they all said, in different but equally banal ways, to get to know him better. He dragged his daughter in and pointed at the screen. Already, she said. He nodded. He had begun to write something admonitory down for her to read, but she was ignoring him, had taken over his chair, was scrolling through each woman's message. No, he said, I don't. And this one, she was saying, what's wrong with this one? But I don't, he said, any of them. No, no, she said, but why not? Daddy, you said you wanted to go on a date. I asked you, Daddy, and you said yes. No, he thought, that was not what he had said. He had said nothing. He opened his mouth. Doctorate, he said. Doctor, she said, and looked at him sharply, her eyes narrowing. Are you all right? That was not what he had meant his mouth to say. Not at all. You prefer the one that's a doctor? His daughter said, clicking open each message in turn as she talked. But I don't think any of them are. But what was he to do, he wondered. First of all, nobody would listen. And second of all, even if they did listen, he himself did not know from moment to moment what, if anything, he was actually going to say. She was there, chattering away in front of him, hardly even hearing what she herself was saying. Why not tell her, he wondered, that something was seriously wrong with him? What was there to be afraid of? But no, he thought. The way people looked at him already, it was almost more than he could bear, and if it came tinged with pity, he would no longer feel human. Better to keep it to himself, hold it to himself as long as possible, and then he would still be, at least in part, human. In the end, he took her by the shoulders and, while she protested, silently pushed her out of the room. His head had started to ache, the pain pooling in his right eye. He closed his door and then returned to the computer, deleting the messages one after another. They were all, he saw, carefully constructed, with each woman trying to present herself as unique or original or witty, but each doing so by employing the same syntactical gestures, the same rhetorical strategies, sometimes even the exact same phrase as the others. This is what it means to be immersed in language, he thought, to lose one's ability to think, to speak other people's words. But the only alternative is not to speak at all. Or was it? Nature of evil, he thought. Define and discuss. Depressed, he glanced through the last three messages. God, his head hurt. The first message was addressed to Silver Fox with three exclamation points following Fox. It was from someone who had adopted the moniker Too Hot to Handle. Music lover or bad speller, he wondered. He deleted it. The second to last one was to F. Silver from Oldie But Goodie. Oh, God, he thought, and deleted it. The pain made his eye feel like a knife was being pushed through it. The eye was beginning to water. He clenched it shut as tight as he could and covered it with his hand. He stood, tipping over his chair, and stumbled about the room, knocking into what must have been walls. Someone was knocking on the door. "Daddy," someone was calling, "are you all right?" Somewhere a dog was growling. He looked up through his good eye and saw, framed in the doorway, a girl. "Tights," he said. "Cardboard boxes." And collapsed. He awoke to a buzzing noise. Saw it was coming from an electric light, fluorescent, inset in the ceiling directly above his head. His daughter was there beside him, looking at his face. He opened his mouth, then closed it again. "No," she said, "just rest." He nodded. He was in a bed, he saw, not his bed. There was a rail to either side of him to hold him in. "I'm going to get the doctor," she claimed. "Don't move." Then she was gone. He closed his eyes, swallowed. The pain in his head was still there, but subdued now and no longer sharpened into a hard point. He rolled his head to one side and back again, pleased that he could still do so. His daughter returned, the doctor beside her, a smallish, tanned man, hardly bigger than her. "Mr. Hecker," the doctor said, setting down a folder and snapping on latex gloves. "How are we feeling?" "Groined," he said. "God damn," he thought. "Your groin hurts. It's your head we're concerned about. But I'll look at your groin, too, if you like." Hecker shook his head. "No? Well, then," said the doctor. "No to the groin, then." He clicked on a penlight, peered into first one eye, then the other. "Any headaches, Mr. Hecker?" He hesitated, nodded. "Head operations in your youth? Surgeries of the head? Cortisone treatments, bad motorcycle wrecks, untreated skull injuries?" Hecker shook his head. "And how are we feeling now?" he asked. Hecker nodded. "Good," he thought. "Good enough." He opened his mouth. The word "good" came out. The doctor nodded. He stripped the gloves off his hands and dropped them into the trash. He came back and sat on the edge of the bed. "I've looked at your x-rays," he said. Hecker nodded. "We should chat," the doctor said. "Would you like your daughter to stay for this?" "Of course I can be here for this," his daughter said. "I'm legally an adult." "Be here for what?" she asked. Hecker shook his head. "No," said the doctor. He turned to Hecker's daughter. "Please wait in the hall," he said. His daughter looked at the doctor and then opened her mouth to speak and then gave a little inarticulate cry and went out. The doctor came closer, sat on the edge of the bed. "Your x-rays," said the doctor. "I don't mean to frighten you, but, well, I'd like to run some tests." He took the folder from the bedside table and took the x-rays out, held them above Hecker in the light. "This cloudiness," he said, "do you see it? I'm concerned." Hecker looked. The dark area, as far as he could tell, ran all the way from one side of his skull to the other. "We'll have to run some tests," said the doctor. "Do you want to let your daughter know?" Hecker hesitated. Did he want to tell her? No, he thought, but he wasn't certain why. Did he want to shield her or simply shield himself from her reaction? Or was it simply he didn't trust words anymore, at least not when they came out of his own mouth? Maybe someone else could tell her. Maybe he would figure out what to do when he had to. "Perhaps no need to frighten her until the results are back," said the doctor, watching him closely. "There's no reason to panic yet," he said. He turned and began to write on his chart. "Any difficulties? Loss of motor skills? Speech problems? Anything out of the ordinary?" Hecker hesitated. Was there any point trying to explain? "Speech," he finally tried to say, but nothing came out. Why nothing, he wondered. Before, there had always at least been something, even if it was the wrong thing. Frustrated, he shook his head. The doctor took it to mean something. He smiled. "That's good then," he said. "Very good indeed." A few days later, waiting for the results of the tests, he began to panic. "First," he thought, "I will lose all language, then I will lose control of my body, then I will die." He tried to push them out of his head, such thoughts, with little success. Now, having resigned from teaching, he didn't know what to do with himself. He sat around the house, read, watched his daughter out of the corner of his eye. He had a hard time getting himself to do anything productive. He felt more and more useless, furtive. She was oblivious, he thought. She had no idea that she would watch him first lose the remainder of his speech, then slowly fall apart, wasting away. Having to live through that, she would probably pray for his death long before it actually arrived. And so will I, he thought. Better to die quickly, he told himself, smoothly, and save both yourself and those close to you. More dignified. He pushed the thought down. It kept rising. His daughter was trying to hand him the telephone. It was the doctor calling with the test results. Standish, Hecker said into the receiver, but the doctor was too worried about what he had to say, about saying it right, in the kindest way possible, in the most neutral words imaginable, to notice. The tests, the doctor claimed, had amplified his concern. What he wanted to do was to recommend a specialist to Hecker, a brain surgeon, a good one, one of the best. He would open Mr. Hecker's skull at a certain optimal spot, take a look at what was really going on in there, and make an assessment of whether it could be cut out, if there was any point in... I didn't mean that, said the doctor nervously. There's always a point. I'm saying it wrong. The proper terminology to describe this was exploratory surgery. Did he understand? Yes, Hecker managed. Was fish guillotine sedentary? Necessary? I'm afraid so, Mr. Hecker. How soon, he wanted to know, could Mr. Hecker put his affairs in order? Not that there was any serious immediate risk, but better safe than sorry. When, he wanted to know, was Mr. Hecker able to schedule the exploratory surgery? Did he have any concerns? Were there any questions that remained to be answered? Hecker opened his mouth to speak, but felt already that anything he said would be wrong, perhaps in several ways at once. So he hung up the telephone. What did he say? His daughter was asking him. Nobody, he said. Wrong finger. First, he thought over and over, I will lose all language. Then I will not be able to control my body. Then I will die. All he could clearly picture when he thought about this was his daughter. Her life crippled for months, perhaps years, by his slow, gradual death. He owed it to her to die quickly. But perhaps, he thought, his daughter's suffering was all he could think about because his own was harder to face. Even as he was now, stripped only partly of language, life was nearly unbearable. First, he thought, and then... He remembered, he hadn't thought about it for years, his own father's death, a gradual move into paralysis until the man was little more than a rattling windpipe in a hospital bed and a pair of eyes that were seldom open and, when they were thick with fear. Like father, like son, he thought. First, he thought, then. He lay in bed staring up at the ceiling. When it was very late and his daughter was asleep, he got up out of bed and climbed up to the attic and took his shotgun out of its case and cleaned it and loaded it. He carried it back downstairs and slid it under his bed. No, he thought. No first, no thens. He was in bed again, staring, thinking. The character of the room seemed to have changed. He could not bear to kill himself with his daughter in the house, he realized. That would be terrible for her, much more terrible than watching him die slowly, and too horrible for him to think about. No, that wouldn't do. He had to get her out. But ever since he had been to the hospital, she had been sticking near him, never far away, observing him. She kept asking him what exactly was wrong with him. What had the doctor told him? Why hadn't she been allowed to hear? And then, what had the doctor said on the telephone? She was always giving him cups of soup, which he took sips from, and then left to scum over on the bookshelves, the fireplace mantle, the windowsills. It wasn't fair, she said. She had only him. They only had each other. But the way he was acting now, she didn't even feel like she had him. What had the doctor said? What exactly was wrong with him? Why wouldn't he tell her? Why wouldn't he speak? All he had to do, she told him, was to open his mouth. But no, that wasn't all. No, it wasn't as simple as that. And yes, he knew he should tell her, but he didn't know what to say or if he could say it. And he didn't want her pity. He wanted only to be what he had always been for her, her father, not an old dying man. But she wouldn't let up. She was making him insane. If she wanted a fight, he would fight. He turned on her and said, utterly fluent, "Don't you have some place to be?" "Yes," she said fiercely, "here." "Fat cats," he misspoke, and suddenly helpless again, turned away. He made a grocery list, a long one, and offered it to her. She glanced at it. "Groceries, Daddy," she said. "Since when did you have anything to do with groceries?" He shrugged. "Besides," she said, "we have half this stuff already. Did you even open the cupboards?" He was beginning to have trouble with one of his fingers. It kept curling and uncurling of its own accord, as if no longer part of his body. He hid it from his daughter under his thigh when he was seated, felt it wriggling there like a half-dead worm. He and his daughter glared at each other from sofa and armchair, respectively, she continuing to hector him with questions, he remaining silent, sullen. He ate, holding his utensils awkwardly to hide the rogue finger from her. She took this as an act of provocation, accused him of acting like a child. It went on for 3 or 4 days, both of them at an impasse, until finally she screamed at him and, when he refused to scream back, left the house. He watched the door clack shut behind her. How long would she be gone? Long enough, he hoped. He got the shotgun out from under the bed and leaned it against the sofa. He dialed 911. "What's your emergency?" a woman's voice responded. "I've just killed myself," he told her. "Hurry, please, cover the body before my daughter gets home." But it didn't come out like that. It was only what his mind was saying, his tongue uttering something else entirely. "Excuse me?" said the operator. He tried again, his voice straining with urgency. "Is this a prank call?" the operator said. "This isn't funny." He fell silent, tried to gather himself. "Sir," said the operator. "Hello?" He looked desperately around the room. The dog was now regarding him intently, ears perked. He picked up the shotgun, held it one-handed near the receiver, and fired it into the wall behind the sofa. The kickback hurt his wrist and made him drop the weapon. The dog skittered out of the room, yelping. He put the receiver to his ear again. The operator was talking more urgently now. He hung up the telephone. Picking up the gun again, he sat down on the sofa. He hoped they would come soon, and that it would be soon enough before his daughter's return. He leaned back and closed his eyes, trying to gather himself. When he was calm again, he braced the shotgun's stock between the insoles of his feet and brought the barrels to his face. Carefully, he slipped the ends of the barrels into his mouth. It was then that his daughter chose to return. He heard her open the front door, and then she came into the room, her face pale. It was clear she had been crying. She came in and saw him and stopped dead, then stood there, her face draining of blood. They stared there like that, staring, neither caring to be the first to look away. He waited, wondering what words he could use, what he could possibly say to her. How could he ever talk his way out of this one? "Daddy," she said finally, "what are you doing?" And then the words came to him. He lifted his mouth off the barrels and licked his lips. "Insect," he explained as tenderly as possibly as he could. "Grunion, tent pole, motioning."
David Strathern read Brian Evanson's story, Mutter Tongue. You are listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts, recorded live at Symphony Space in New York City. Symphony Space's season is sponsored by Zabar's, offering the nation a taste of New York. Coffee, gourmet foods, and gift baskets available online at zabars.com. We'll conclude this program with a story called Mr. Badger, which is really an excerpt from Kenneth Graham's beloved Wind in the Willows. This was part of a program, or a series of programs, we did at the Getty Center in Los Angeles entitled Food Fictions. And in this story, little animals make a lot of food. And it's read for us by the actress Samantha Eggar, who starred in Dr. Dolittle, which also had to do with little animals. Samantha Eggar reads Mr. Badger.
They waited patiently for what seemed a very long time, stamping in the snow to keep their feet warm. At last, they heard the sound of slow, shuffling footsteps approaching the door from the inside. It seemed, as the mole remarked to the rat, like someone walking in carpet slippers that were too large for him and down at heel, which was intelligent of mole because that was exactly what it was. There was a noise of a bolt shot back, and the door opened a few inches, enough to show a long snout and a pair of sleepy, blinking eyes.
"Now, the very next time this happens," said a gruff and suspicious voice, "I shall be exceedingly angry. Who is it this time disturbing people on such a night? Speak up,
Oh, Badger!" cried the rat. "Let us in, please. It's me, Rat, and my friend Mole, and we've lost our way in the snow."
"What? Ratty, my dear little man," exclaimed the badger in quite a different voice. "Oh, come along in, both of you, at once. Oh, why, you must be perished. Well, I never. Lost in the snow and in the wild wood, too, and at this time of night. Oh, come in, come in."
The two animals tumbled over each other in their eagerness to get inside, and heard the door shut behind them with great joy and relief. The badger, who wore a long dressing gown and whose slippers were indeed very down at heel, carried a flat candlestick in his paw and had probably been on his way to bed when their summons sounded. He looked kindly down on them and patted both their heads.
This is not the sort of night for small animals to be out," he said paternally. "I'm afraid you've been up to some of your pranks again, Ratty. But come along, come into the kitchen. There's a first-rate fire there and supper and everything."
He shuffled on in front of them, carrying the light, and they followed him, nudging each other in an anticipating sort of way, down a long, gloomy, and to tell the truth, decidedly shabby passage, into a sort of central hall, out of which they could dimly see other long, tunnel-like passages branching, passages mysterious and without apparent end. But there were doors in the hall as well, stout, oaken, comfortable-looking doors. One of these the badger flung open, and at once they found themselves in all the glow and warmth of a large, firelit kitchen. The floor was well-worn red brick, and on the wide hearth burned a fire of logs between two attractive chimney corners tucked away in the wall, well out of any suspicion of draughts. A couple of high-backed settles facing each other on either side of the fire gave further sitting accommodation for the socially disposed. In the middle of the room stood a long table of plain boards placed on trestles with benches down each side. At one end of it, where an armchair stood pushed back, were spread the remains of the badger's plain but ample supper. Rows of spotless plates winked from the shelves on the dresser at the far end of the room, and from the rafters overhead hung hams and bundles of dried herbs, nets of onions, and baskets of eggs. It seemed a place where heroes could fitly feast after victory, where weary harvesters could line up in scores along the table and keep their harvest home with mirth and song, or where two or three friends of simple tastes could sit about as they pleased and eat and smoke and talk in comfort and contentment. The ruddy brick floor smiled up at the smoky ceiling. The oaken settles, shiny with long wear, exchanged cheerful glances with each other. Plates on the dresser grinned at pots on the shelf, and the merry firelight flickered and played over everything without distinction. The kindly badger thrust them down on a settle to toast themselves at the fire and bade them remove their wet coats and boots. Then he fetched them dressing gowns and slippers and himself bathed the mole's shin with warm water and mended the cut with sticking plaster till the whole thing was just as good as new, if not better. In the embracing light and warmth, warm and dry at last, with weary legs propped up in front of them, and a suggestive clink of plates being arranged on the table behind, it seemed to the storm-driven animals, now in safe anchorage, that the cold and trackless wild wood just left outside was miles and miles away, and all that they had had suffered in it a half-forgotten dream. When at last they were thoroughly toasted, the badger summoned them to the table, where he had been busy laying a repast. They'd felt pretty hungry before, but when they actually saw at last the supper that was spread for them, really, it seemed only a question of what they should attract first, where all was so attractive, and whether the other things would obligingly wait for them till they had time to give them attention. Conversation was impossible for a long time, and when it was slowly resumed, it was that regrettable sort of conversation that results from talking with your mouth full. The badger didn't mind that sort of thing at all. Nor did he take any notice of elbows on the table or everybody speaking at once. As he did not go into society himself, he had got an idea that these things belonged to things that didn't really matter. Well, we know, of course, that he was wrong, and it would have taken a long time to explain that, because it doesn't matter very much. He sat in his armchair at the head of the table and nodded gravely at intervals as the animals told their story. And he did not seem surprised or shocked at anything, and he never said, "I told you so," or "just what I always said," or remarked that they ought to have done so-and-so and ought not to have done something else. The mole began to feel very friendly towards him. When supper was really finished at last, and each animal felt that his skin was now as tight as was decently safe, and that by this time he didn't care a hang for anybody or anything, They gathered round the glowing embers of the great wood fire and thought how jolly it was to be sitting up so late and so independent and so full. "Well, it's time we all were in bed," said the badger, getting up and fetching flat candlesticks. "Come along, you two, and I'll show you your quarters. And take your time tomorrow morning. Breakfast at any hour you please." He conducted the two animals to a long room that seemed half bedchamber and half loft. The badger's winter stores, which indeed were visible everywhere, took up half the room. Piles of apples, turnips and potatoes, baskets full of nuts and jars of honey. But the two little white beds on the remainder of the floor looked soft and inviting, and the linen on them, though coarse, was clean and smelled beautifully of lavender. And the mole and the water rat, shaking off their garments in some 30 seconds, tumbled in between the sheets in great joy and contentment. In accordance with the kindly badger's injunctions, the two tired animals came down to breakfast very late next morning and found a bright fire burning in the kitchen and two young hedgehogs sitting on a bench at the table, eating oatmeal porridge out of wooden bowls. The hedgehogs dropped their spoons, rose to their feet, and ducked their heads respectfully as the two entered. "Oh, there, sit down," said the rat pleasantly. "Go on with your porridge. Where have you youngsters come from?" "Lost away in the snow, I suppose."
Yes, please, sir," said the elder of the two hedgehogs respectfully. "Me and little Billy here, we was trying to find our way to school. Mother would have us go, was the weather ever so, and of course we lost ourselves, sir, and Billy got frightened and took and cried, being young and faint-hearted. And at last we happened up against Mr. Badger's back door and made so bold as to knock, sir. And Mr. Badger, he's a kind-hearted gentleman, as everyone knows."
"I understand," said the rat, cutting himself some rashers from a side of bacon, while the mole dropped some eggs into the saucepan. "And what's the weather like outside? You needn't sir me quite so much," he added.
"Oh, terrible bad, sir. Terrible deep the snow is," said the hedgehog. "No getting out for the likes of you gentlemen today."
"Where's Mr. Badger?" inquired the mole, as he warmed the coffee pot before the fire.
The master's gone into the study, sir," replied the hedgehog. And he said as how he was going to be particularly busy this morning, and on no account was he to be disturbed."
This explanation, of course, was thoroughly understood by everyone present. The fact is, as already set forth, when you live a life of intense activity for 6 months in the year and of comparative or actual somnolence for the other six, during the latter period, you cannot be continually pleading sleepiness when there are people about or things to be done. The excuse gets rather monotonous. The animals well knew that Badger, having eaten a hearty breakfast, had retired to his study, settled himself in an armchair with his legs up on another, and a red cotton handkerchief over his face, and was being busy in the usual way at this time of the year. The front doorbell clanged loudly, and the rat, who was very greasy with buttered toast, sent Billy, the smaller hedgehog, to see who it might be. There was a sound of much stamping in the hall, and presently Billy returned in front of the otter, who threw himself on the rat with an embrace and a shout of an affectionate greeting.
"Get off," spluttered the rat with his mouth full. "Oh, I thought I'd find you here all right," said the otter cheerfully. Oh, they were all in a great state of alarm along the riverbank when I arrived this morning. Rat, never been home all night, nor mole neither. Something dreadful must have happened, they said, and the snow had covered up all your tracks, of course. But I knew that when people were in any fix, they mostly went to Badger, or else Badger got to know of it somehow, so I come off straight here through the wild wood and the snow. Oh, my, it was fine. Coming through the snow as the red sun was rising, showing against the black tree trunks. I mean, as you went along in the stillness, every now and then, masses of snow slid off the branches suddenly with a flop, making you jump, run for cover. Oh, it was sandcastles. Snow caverns sprung up out of nowhere in the night. Snow bridges, terraces, ramparts. I could have stayed and played with them for hours. And here and there, great branches had been torn away by the sheer weight of the snow. And those robins perched and hopped on them in their perky, conceited way, as if they'd done it all them life themselves. A ragged string of wild geese passed overhead, high on the grey sky. Threw rooks, whirled over the trees, inspected, flapped off homewards. Disgusted expression. But I met no sensible being to ask the news of. About halfway across, I come on a rabbit, sitting on a stump, cleaning his silly face with his paws. He was pretty scared animal when I crept up behind him. I placed an heavy oar paw on his shoulder. Had to cuff his head once or twice, get any sense out of it at all. At last, I managed to extract from him that mole had been seen in the wild wood last night by one of them. Talk of the burrows, he said. Our mole, Mr. Rat's particular friend, was in a bad fix, how he got lost. And they were up and out hunting and were chivving him round and round. Then why didn't any of you do something? I asked. You mayn't be blessed with brains, but there are hundreds and hundreds of you. Big, stout fellas, fat as butter. Your burrows running in all directions. You could have taken him in and made him safe and comfortable, or tried to at all events. What? Us? He merely said. Do something. Us rabbits. So I cuffed him again, left him there, didn't I? There's nothing else to be done. At any rate, I had learnt something. And if I'd had the luck to meet any of them, I'd have learned them something. Yeah, I sure would.
Weren't you at all nervous?
Asked the mole. Some of yesterday's terror coming back to him at the mention of the wild wood.
Nervous!
The otter showed a gleaming set of strong white teeth as he laughed. I'd give them nerves if any of them tried anything on with me. Here, mole, fry me up some slices of ham like a good little chap. Oh, I'm hungry. And I've got any amount to say to Rat here. I haven't seen him for an age. So the good-natured mole, having cut some slices of ham, set the hedgehogs to fry it and returned to his own breakfast, while Otter and the Rat, their heads together, eagerly talking river shop, which is long shop and talk that is endless, running on like the babbling river itself. A plate of fried ham had just been cleared and sent back for more when Badger entered. Yawning and rubbing his eyes, he greeted them all in his quiet, simple way with kind inquiries for everyone.
It must be getting on for luncheon time,
he remarked to the otter.
Better stop and have it with us. You must be hungry this cold morning. Or rather, replied the otter, winking at them all.
Sight of these greedy young hedgehogs stuffing themselves with fried ham makes me positively famished. The hedgehogs, who were just beginning to feel hungry again after their porridge,
and after working so hard at their frying, look timidly up at Mr. Badger. But we're too shy to say anything. Here, you two youngsters, be off home to your mother, said the Badger kindly. I'll send someone with you to show you the way. You won't want any dinner today, I'll be bound. He gave them sixpence apiece and a pat on the head, and they went off with much respectful swinging of caps and touching of forelocks.
That was Samantha Egger reading Mr. Badger from Kenneth Graham's Wind in the Willows. We know you like listening to short stories, and have you ever wondered whether you could write one? Why not enter our annual Stella Kupferberg Memorial Short Story Prize Contest? Details are available at our website, selectedshorts.org. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2007 by Stephen King, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is given by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund in the New York Community Trust, the Henry Nias Foundation, the Axe Houghton Foundation, the Arthur Foundation, and members of the Symphony Space Literature Producers Circle. Public funds come from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art, and the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York, and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.